This lecture is produced by Stone Kingdom Ministries of Asheville, North Carolina. Follow along in your Bible as James Brueggemann shares good news from God's Word. For a sample copy of our publication and a catalog of the resources available, write to Stone Kingdom Ministries, Post Office Box 5695, Asheville, North Carolina, zip code 28813. You may also visit us on the web at www.stonekingdom.org. Your regular financial support is what makes this ministry possible, and we are grateful to you for that. And now, here is Bible teacher James Brueggemann.
Turn to 2 Samuel chapter 16. We've been studying the character of David and Saul, lo, these many months now. And although King Saul has been long removed from the scene, we've discovered that David's own son, Absalom, or as I like to call him, Absalom, is of the same spirit as King Saul. And thus, in our understanding of the types and shadows in the life of David, we recognize Absalom as another Saul type. When we left off last time, Absalom had conspired with Ahithophel to effect a coup d'etat, to topple David from the throne and take it for himself. When King David in Jerusalem got word that Absalom had amassed an army and was on his way to Jerusalem already, David let it be known that anyone who wished to join him as he left Jerusalem was welcome to do so. And as they were in the Kidron Valley and later on the Mount of Olives, David took several steps to try to thwart the plans of his rebellious son. He told the co-high priests, Zadok and Abiathar, to return to Jerusalem with the Ark of the Covenant. He told them that they could be his eyes and ears in the capital, and that they should use their respective sons, Ahimaaz and Jonathan, as couriers to bring back reports to David. Then David also sent his good friend and trusted counselor named Hushai, the Archite, back to Jerusalem. He instructed him to try to get as close as possible to Absalom and learn whatever intelligence he could. And Hushai was then to relay this information to either of the high priests, who would then send it back to David through their sons as couriers. Finally, as David and his Delta forces are making their way through the territory of Benjamin, Saul's tribe, one of Saul's loyalists, a man named Shimei, began stoning David. And David, if you'll recall, restrained his commandos from eliminating this threat because David sensed that God was speaking through David's enemy. Remember that? Are we learning to hear God yet through our personal enemies? Can we see those enemies as, in the final analysis, being for our good? That should be one of the goals of a prospective overcomer. Well, David and his sizable entourage made it through Shimei's gauntlet and came to a place of rest, probably right on the western shore of the Jordan River. Let's begin in 2 Samuel 16:13. Just a couple verses of review from last time where we left off. As David and his men went by the way, Shimei went along on the hill's side over against him and cursed as he went and threw stones at him and cast dust. And the king and all the people that were with him became weary and refreshed themselves there. And Absalom and all the people, the men of Jerusalem, came to Jerusalem, and Ahithophel with them. Now when Absalom and his fellow conspirators came marching or riding into Jerusalem, there were some, perhaps many, people who had cast their lot with Absalom. And of course, they would have welcomed him as a liberator. Among the cheering crowds would have been the two high priests. Their two sons stayed outside of town, as we will see later. And also helping line the parade route was David's other undercover agent, Hushai the Archite. Verse 16, and it came to pass when Hushai the Archite, David's friend, was come unto Absalom, that Hushai said unto Absalom, God save the king! God save the king! So Hushai plays the role of the spy, pretending great friendship and loyalty to the new king. Now, of course, you could take what he said in two ways, couldn't you? God save the king. In Hushai's mind, it was God save David. But Absalom, being proud, would see that as homage to himself. But Absalom is a little suspicious at first, and it takes a bit of play acting and clever talking by Hushai to persuade him otherwise. Verse 17, "And Absalom said to Hushai, Is this thy friendness, this thy kindness to thy friend? Why wentest thou not with thy friend? And Hushai said unto Absalom, Nay, but whom Yahweh and this people and all the men of Israel choose, his will I be, and with him will I abide. And again, whom should I serve? Should I not serve in the presence of his son? As I have served in thy father's presence, so will I be in thy presence." We notice that Hushai's first response to Absalom's questioning his loyalty is to proclaim in so many words that, well, David has fled, and you're here, and therefore it's obvious that Yahweh has chosen you to be the king now. To me, this again is another lesson in how God's sovereignty works, and it follows naturally on the similar point that I made last time, the point about the relationship between God's sovereignty and fatalism among Christians, or stated another way, it's about the relationship between God's sovereignty and apathetic attitudes on the part of believers. Just as an aside, we all in this room probably understand how people who believe in an any moment now rapture of all believers can easily develop a do-nothing attitude, apathy. But this is also a pitfall for those of us who believe in God's absolute sovereignty. In the situation in the narrative here, I see it like this. God is indeed in control of all things, down to the tiniest details. And while we can truthfully state that whatever happens was meant to happen, that does not mean that we must be passive onlookers to everything that happens, because that's the Oriental philosophy of fatalism. You see, Hushai's clever statements were meant to deceive Absalom by causing him to think that Hushai was a fatalist, that Hushai had the idea that, well, if you're here and David's gone, then obviously God meant for you to be the king, and my job is to serve the king. Well, that satisfies Absalom, and he lets Hushai take his seat among his inner circle of counselors. But what Absalom did not know was that while Hushai did believe that God had ordained this event, bad as it was, Hushai also believed that God's sovereignty allowed, or we could say God's sovereignty ordained, that Hushai be an undercover agent to work to overthrow the rebel Absalom. So the principle here that I want us to fully understand is that no matter what happens in our lives, we can always choose how to react. We must never allow laziness or apathy or fatalism to set in and become our mode of life. God gives us minds with great capabilities, and he expects us to use them. In this case, both David and Hushai could have taken the fatalistic attitude, which would have sounded like this. Well, Absalom seems to have the upper hand here now, so I guess that means that my reign as king is over. I guess I'll just sit here and wait for him to come and assassinate me, because it's obvious that's God's sovereign plan. Boo-hoo-hoo. No, David did not think like that. He fully believed in the sovereignty of God, but because he really did not know what the outcome of Absalom's rebellion was going to be, he was free to choose how to react. So he was decisive and chose to send some undercover spies back to Jerusalem and to fight for his throne. God indeed controls every detail of everyone's life from beginning to end, but the beauty of it, the utterly dazzling brilliance of the Father, is that he does not let us know the future. Therefore, what is from his point of view, the illusion of free will, is, from our point of view and for all practical purposes, the reality of free will. This is why David was not a fatalist. Let me repeat the key verses from our previous message. You don't need to turn there. 2 Samuel 15, 25 and 6. And the king said unto Zadok, carry back the ark of God into the city. If, he doesn't know, if I shall find favor in the eyes of Yahweh, he will bring me back again and show me both it and his habitation. But if he thus say, I have no delight in thee, behold, here am I. Let him do to me as seemeth good to him. You see, David did not know the future, and for all practical purposes, from his perspective, he had the free will to choose to either roll over and die or to use all his talents and resources to prevent the success of Absalom's attempted coup d'etat. Therefore, he fled Jerusalem. Therefore, he sent Zadok and Abiathar back with the Ark of the Covenant with instructions to set up an intelligence network. Therefore, he sent Hushai back to Jerusalem also as his point man in Absalom's inner circle. Of course, he didn't know if Hushai would be successful in being accepted in Absalom's inner circle, and if Hushai failed to penetrate that inner circle, David would accept that failure as God's plan. But then the same choice would confront David all over again. At that point then, does he roll over and die? Or does he use his noggin to try to come up with another plan to try to thwart Absalom's plan? Now I hope we can all grasp this very important principle of the sovereignty of God. And the reason I'm elaborating upon it recently is because I've had quite a few people write me, call me, or otherwise tell me they're having difficulty grasping it. And so I will continue for some time to expound upon it whenever it arises in the text, as it has here. At this point in our story, though, Hushai is now in the personal presence of the man who would be king. Hushai's mind was getting a serious workout because he needed to choose his words very carefully, because one mistake and he would find himself headed 6 feet under. By God's plan, though, Absalom bought into Hushai's affirmations of loyalty. It is thus so ironic that we see Absalom, the man who had stood at the gates and gained the hearts of the people by flattery, was himself susceptible to be deceived by the flattery of Hushai. Then, having believed Hushai, Absalom calls for a cabinet meeting to decide upon his next course of action. Verse 20. Then said Absalom to Ahithophel, give counsel among you what we shall do. And Ahithophel said unto Absalom, go in unto thy father's concubines, which he hath left to keep the house, and all Israel shall hear that thou art abhorred of thy father, then shall the hands of all that are with thee be strong. Ahithophel saw that now was not the time for half measures. He needed to have Absalom do something that would immediately and forever make reconciliation impossible between David and Absalom. And only in this way could Ahithophel feel that he and all the other co-conspirators were safe. He had to advise something from which there would be no chance of ever going back. And so he advised Absalom to do something that was so bold, so audacious, something that would be so in your face, David, that when David is unable to respond to this most heinous insult, that it would demonstrate to all the people that you, O great Absalom, you are now the king. You have all the power. Furthermore, in Ahithophel's mind, this advice was equally self-serving because David, being the kind of character that he was, there was always the possibility that somehow David would find it in his heart to forgive Absalom. And then Ahithophel might not fare as well. He might be the one executed as the mastermind of the whole conspiracy, which he may indeed have been. We really don't know. But if he could persuade Absalom to do such an atrocious act, this would most likely create a chasm so wide it could never be spanned. Not only that, but all those men who had been at the big Texas barbecue party, you remember, and were persuaded in the heat of emotion to join Absalom's conspiracy, this would also force all of them to continue their support for Absalom. Absalom liked the in-your-face idea. 22. So they spread Absalom a tent upon the top of the house, and Absalom went in unto his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. In my mind, it's also quite possible that Ahithophel, in his bitterness for what David had done to Uriah, Bathsheba, and her family, of which Ahithophel was her grandfather, you recall, that Absalom ravishing the harem would be giving David a taste of his own medicine. It was a revenge motive on the part of Ahithophel. And by the way, where was that tent erected, do you suppose? It was on the roof of the palace. The very place where David had gazed down upon Bathsheba and set all these events in motion. Does God have his ways of balancing things out or what? Now, do you remember from the last time how many concubines David had left at the palace? And it's on your chart that I handed out to you. Yes, Arden. You got it. Give him a sucker. It was 10, yes, of course. These 10 concubines, I wonder what they represent in type. The lost 10 tribes of Israel who, over the centuries before and after Christ, have been ravished by Saul types. In other words, by corrupt leaders and wannabe leaders of both church and state. Yeah. Well, what else could the 10 concubines represent? How about this? Since David represents the overcomers, the barley company, perhaps the concubines represent the wheat company who are left behind. Because while David flees into the wilderness, he chooses not to take these 10 along with him. They were not his beloved wives. They were merely concubines. Probably most of them had been acquired through as guarantees of political treaties, as was the custom in those days. So David and his company fled into the wilderness. Now, in the church age, the overcomers have often fled into the wilderness. They did it literally in the Dark Ages in Europe. They fled into the valleys of the Alps and into the René-Les-Châteaux region of southern France, the Cathars, the Albigensians, the Waldensians, etc. And I'm not saying that they were all perfect people or they had all perfect doctrine. I'm just saying they wanted to escape from the predominant, overbearing power of the Church of Rome. And so they were cast out, as it were. Well, not only literally have they fled into the wilderness, but overcomers have figuratively fled into the wilderness as they fled established churches to the present day and have been in a spiritual wilderness for a season. Those who remain behind in the denominational church system are often ravished and abused by Saul types, the Absaloms. Now, someone might wish to make a link to the parable of the 10 virgins, but I don't see how you can make a connection there. You'd have to show me how the 5 wise and the 5 foolish virgins fit into it. Now, if you have some ideas on that, see me after class. 23. And the counsel of Ahithophel, which he counseled in those days, was as if a man had inquired at the oracle of God. So was all the counsel of Ahithophel, both with David and with Absalom. This is a very curious verse, and it leads me to 2 conclusions. It tells us that, number one, Ahithophel had a reputation for great wisdom, and therefore his advice would be highly valued, and it was advice that had been greatly relied upon by David. Secondly, we notice the very curious way in which we're told that Ahithophel is a very wise man. The sacred author states that Ahithophel's counsel was as if a man had inquired at the oracle of God. What's another name for the oracle of God? No, not specifically. The Holy of Holies compartment in the tabernacle or the temple. Is that not right, Ron? It was called the oracle because that's where the Ark of the Covenant was located. The scriptures tell us that above the mercy seat of the ark is where God would communicate with Israel. But not with the whole nation at once, was it? Because only one man in one office could go into that compartment once a year. And who was that?
The high priest.
So when it says that Ahithophel's counsel was as if a man had inquired at the oracle of God, it is associating Ahithophel with the high priest, isn't it? And now look at the advice this type of the high priest is giving. He's counseling Absalom to commit a very ungodly act, and more than that, to flaunt it. Do it in broad daylight. If you remember, and we mentioned this in our last lecture, how the sons of Eli, the priest at the time of Samuel, how the sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, lay with the women at the door of the tabernacle. And so we see how this metaphorically and symbolically connects Ahithophel with the line of Eli, that priesthood line. It's a priesthood which is now, as we are in this story, that priesthood is on its way out to be replaced shortly by the line of the Zadok priesthood, which culminates in Jesus. Jesus, remember, was of the tribe of Judah, not the tribe of Levi. And the Levite tribe was the priestly tribe. And therefore, the new priesthood after the order of Melchizedek, as they say, meaning after the line of Melchizedek, that priesthood replaces the Levitical priesthood. And do you see the name Zadok in Melchizedek? Z-D-K? There were no vowels in the original Hebrew. Zadok or Zadek, the same word. And that's why it doesn't matter which tribe we are from in terms of the priesthood, because we can all be priests in the order of Melchizedek, sub-priests under our eternal high priest, Jesus Christ. My final comment on this verse is that it has a further double meaning. You see, in likening Ahithophel's advice to the oracle of God, it's also likening his words to the word of God. And in following Ahithophel's advice to commit this heinous act, Absalom is actually fulfilling precisely the word of God, which Nathan had given after David had sinned with Bathsheba. That was back in 2 Samuel 12:11, where Nathan had said, "Therefore saith Yahweh, behold, I will raise up evil against thee out of thine own house, and I will take thine wives from before thine eyes and give them unto thy neighbor," meaning Absalom, his son, "and he shall lie with thy wives in the sight of this son. For thou didst it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and before the sun." You thought the devil did it. Where have you been? You're saying God did this evil? No. God's punishment upon David was delayed many years, but it came nevertheless. Ironically, it came about as a result of David's own trusted and senior counselor, Ahithophel. Apparently, Absalom ravished the concubines immediately, because later that same day, Ahithophel gives his counsel on how Absalom should secure the throne for himself. Chapter 17, verse 1. "Moreover, Ahithophel said unto Absalom, Let me now choose out 12,000 men, and I will arise and pursue after David this night. And I will come upon him while he is weary and weak-handed, and will make him afraid, and all the people that are with him shall flee, and I will smite the king only. And I will bring back all the people unto thee. The man whom thou seekest is as if all returned, so all the people shall be in peace." Let's analyze this advice. Ahithophel thinks the smartest thing to do is to immediately assemble a sizable contingent of troops and go after David before David has time to get organized. Ahithophel knows that David has been slowed down in his flight because he has a large number of women and children with him. Ahithophel figures, if they can march through the night, they'll catch up with David before he has a chance to cross the Jordan River and organize his troops. He points out that David and his entourage will be weak and weary, so that when 12,000 soldiers approach David's camp, the people will flee out of sheer fright. Then, Ahithophel proposes, "I will strike David only," or in other words, David alone, by himself. Try not to kill anybody else, just kill David. Because Ahithophel realizes that if, as long as David is alive, Absalom can never be secure on the throne, and Ahithophel himself would remain in danger as a traitor. His one overriding goal, therefore, is to assassinate his king. After that, he figures, Absalom can provide amnesty for all the other people that fled with David. And they will then come back and be loyal to Absalom because he's already on the throne, he's the next in line, etc. Now, frankly, this was a pretty sound plan. The key to its success, however, lay in the fact that Absalom had to act immediately. So what did Absalom think of this advice? Well, verse 4 says, "And the saying pleased Absalom well, and all the elders of Israel. Then said Absalom, call now Hushai the Archite also, and let us hear likewise what he saith." This is most interesting. Absalom has already heard the sage advice of the most reputable counselor in the realm. He likes the advice. All his top-ranking conspirators like the advice. But then, for some strange reason, Absalom chooses to decide to ask counsel from Hushai the Archite. Gee, I wonder who could have caused Absalom to ask for this advice. A move that will ultimately prove fatal to his plan. Wonder who that could have been. "I see you, Father. This looks like your handiwork." Our father seems to have his hands in everything, doesn't he? Verse 6 says, "And when Hushai was come to Absalom, Absalom spake unto him, saying, Ahithophel hath spoken after this manner. Shall we do after his saying? If not, speak thou." Now, let's notice the contrast between Ahithophel's advice and the plan suggested by Hushai. 7. "And Hushai said unto Absalom, the counsel that Ahithophel hath given is not good at this time." So first Hushai adds the phrase, "at this time." By this, Hushai is seemingly saying that Ahithophel's earlier advice for Absalom to lay with his father's concubines was indeed good advice. And by appearing to approve of this deed, Hushai not only thereby strengthens his relationship with Absalom, because he's basically giving Absalom an attaboy, you know, a pat on the back, but it serves to lend more credence to Hushai now that he's setting forth an alternative to Ahithophel's plan. And so the following, then, is God's method of answering David's earlier prayer, remember this last time, to turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. Ahithophel's advice becomes foolishness in the mind of Absalom when he hears the following counsel from Hushai. Verse 8, "For, said Hushai, thou knowest thy father and his men, that they be mighty men, and they be chafed in their minds," that means they're inflamed with anger, "as a bear robbed of her whelps in the field, and thy father is a man of war, and will not lodge with the people." So Hushai uses fear as the very first of his rhetorical devices to persuade Absalom to follow his counsel. Whereas Ahithophel declared that David and his men would be weak and weary, Hushai says, "Look, Absalom, you know your father and his mighty men. They're not 97-pound weaklings. These are men accustomed to war, and they have a reason right now to be fighting mad." And he uses a word picture which would be quite familiar and quite vivid for all the people in those days, that of a mother bear being robbed of her cub. That is a picture of rage. And thus Hushai begins to plant fear in the mind of Absalom, so he will be more receptive to follow the rest of the plan. Contrary to Ahithophel's belief that the women and children will slow David down, Hushai points out that David and his mighty men will separate from them. Hushai says to Absalom, "You know, you won't find David and his men like sitting ducks out there on the plain in the wilderness by the Jordan." And he then continues, verse 9, "Behold, he is hid now in some pit or in some other place, and it will come to pass when some of them be overthrown at the first that whosoever heareth it will say, there is a slaughter among the people that follow Absalom. And he also that is valiant, whose heart is as the heart of a lion, shall utterly melt. For all Israel knoweth that thy father is a mighty man, and they which be with him are valiant men." So Hushai is now laying it on thick to reinforce the fear motive. He's saying, look, Absalom, your father was learning to survive and was living in caves in the wilderness fleeing Saul long before you were ever born. He is a master of warfare in the wilderness. And you know what will happen? He and his men, they won't be out in the open. They'll be in hiding places, in various holes. And when your 12,000 men go out there, David and his men will begin picking them off one by one. And your soldiers won't even know where the attack came from. Your father is a master of disguise. Even your bravest soldiers will get scared going up against your warrior father. And then when word gets back here that your troops are not only suffering some casualties, but that they can't even find where the shots are coming from, well, your royal majesty, then you will have a big morale problem, because the people who followed you will begin to waver, and you'll be in serious trouble then. And so having thus planted the fear motive deep into Absalom's psyche, Hushai then appeals to Absalom's pride and ego. And this could also be a left-handed jab against Ahithophel, because Ahithophel was proposing to lead the troops himself and get all the glory. Listen now, verse 11. Therefore I counsel that all Israel be gathered unto thee. Unto thee. From Dan even to Beersheba, as the sand is by the sea for multitude, and that thou go to battle in thine own person. You see how Hushai paints this picture of a vast army as the sand by the sea for multitude, and Absalom visualizes himself at the head of it. Now, it's possible that Absalom had never himself lifted a bow in battle. He was a prideful man, and this certainly appealed to his enormous ego. Hushai continues with the word pictures now, incorporating himself as standing right alongside his new king. Verse 12, so shall we come upon him in some place where he shall be found, and we will light upon him as the dew falleth on the ground, and of him and of all the men that are with him there shall not be left so much as one. Moreover, if he be gotten into a city, then shall all Israel bring ropes to that city, and we will draw it into the river until there not be one small stone found there. Of course, a little bit of hyperbole here. And thus Hushai is painting this panoramic picture of a glorious victory with Absalom playing the starring role. You can just see Absalom beginning to beam from ear to ear as Hushai finishes his proposal. 14. And Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. And now listen carefully. For Yahweh had appointed to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel, to the intent that Yahweh might bring evil upon Absalom. Can anyone ask any more for a statement any more clear than that concerning the sovereignty of God? Incidentally, notice that the counsel of Ahithophel is characterized as good. Does that mean God approved of Absalom's ravishing the 10 concubines? Not necessarily. One explanation could be that it was good advice from Absalom's perspective, not that it was good and righteous and morally upright in the absolute sense, but it was good from a political maneuvering point of view. Another explanation is that the good advice being referred to is only that advice by Ahithophel on how to remove David from the scene. That was good advice. But as we've seen, God caused Absalom to ultimately decide that Hushai's advice was superior, and thus Ahithophel's advice was relegated to foolishness, comparatively speaking. And then, in keeping with the intelligence plans of David, Hushai gets the word to the co-high priests of what has just transpired. Verse 15. Then said Hushai unto Zadok and to Abiathar the priests, thus and thus did Ahithophel counsel Absalom and all the elders of Israel, and thus have I counseled. Now therefore, send quickly and tell David, saying, lodge not this night in the plains of the wilderness, but speedily pass over, lest the king be swallowed up and all the people that are with him. At this point, it's clear that although the advice of both Ahithophel and Hushai has been heard, that Absalom has not yet made a final decision. This is why Hushai is telling the priests what his advice was and what Ahithophel's advice was. Time was of the essence in getting this intelligence to David soon as possible. Fortunately, or better said, providentially, Absalom's delay in making a decision is bad news for Ahithophel, because every minute wasted in indecision is providing David more and more time to escape across Jordan. The Saul character in Absalom is manifesting now in a number of ways. First, he's proud. His ego causes him to see the world unrealistically, as though he could command the armies of Israel and even think that he could have success against his warrior father and his elite Delta forces. Absalom's indecisiveness, another character trait, has just rendered moot Ahithophel's plan of action. Now, there is a general principle to be observed here which can benefit all of us. It is that indecisiveness sometimes leads to the wrong decision by default. In many cases, it's a situation where by not deciding affirmatively to do something, you've actually by default made the decision not to do it. You can think up any number of examples. Perhaps some have occurred in your own life. For example, supposing you were going for a job interview. Like most of the things that you've liked, you figure in the interview that by the time it's done, you think you like most of the things about the job, but you're not quite sure, and so you tell the interviewer you need a little bit of time to think about it, so you're going to call him back tomorrow. And of course, when you call back tomorrow, the job's been filled. Or here's one that happened to me many years ago. We were looking for a house to rent, and we went to look at one. It was pretty nice. But for some reason I can't remember at the moment, my wife and I decided just to go out to the car and sit in the front seat and talk about it for a few minutes. And while we were doing that, someone else came and took a tour of the house. After a few minutes, we decided that we'd like the house, and we'd go in and tell the agent or the owner, forget who it was. And just at that time, he was coming out and down the front steps with the other looker and had just received the deposit, you know. Yeah. Well, we learned from that incident, and the next house that we rented, nearly the same thing happened. We took the tour, we liked it, and as we walked out onto the front porch after the tour, the rental agent said he had another looker that was due to arrive any moment. I looked at my wife, she smiled and nodded, I said, "We'll take it."
And the other person never showed up.
No, actually they did. Just as we finished signing the lease, they did show up. Yeah.
That's in the renter's handbook. That's
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I realize it. But we'd gotten burned. Sure.
The landlord's handbook, son.
Or real estate agent's handbook. So the character quality of decisiveness is one that was lacking in Absalom and is lacking in many Saul types, some of whom you may know. Of course, this must be balanced because one can also go to the opposite extreme and have the negative quality of being impulsive or reckless and irresponsible, right? Decisiveness, therefore, must have wisdom and discernment as her handmaidens. Here, Absalom's indecisiveness contrasts sharply with David, as we will see in a moment. Now, a second general principle we can draw from the story thus far today is that a person who is highly susceptible to flattery can also be controlled by flattery. Person who is susceptible to flattery can also be controlled by flattery. It's the vice of pride which makes one susceptible to flattery. Hushai's appeal to Absalom's pride and vanity ultimately made him putty in Hushai's hands. And it was this which led to Absalom's downfall, thus illustrating how pride goes before the fall. Pride, flattery, fall. A third universally true principle which is evident in this story is that fear is one of the strongest means of controlling people. A person who can cause you to fear either him or circumstances, a person who can cause you to fear can ultimately control you. Do you think this is being practiced on a mass scale? Hello. It applies at every level of society, from the family to the government. We hear of horrible stories extant concerning husbands who batter their wives. They control the wife with the threat of more violence. And it takes great courage on the part of wives to overcome that fear enough to seek help. At the national level, despots Dictators and totalitarians of every stripe and in every age have understood this principle quite thoroughly. This past week marked the 50th anniversary of the death of Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin. Many of you know that Stalin was not his real name, but then Hitler was not his real name either, and we won't go into that at this point. However, Stalin is one of the premier examples of a man who controlled a huge chunk of the geography of the globe by means of extreme fear. Stalin was responsible for the deaths of perhaps as many as 30 million people. Some of you are saying more than that. Okay, I'm trying to be conservative. In the Soviet Union, mostly Christians, over the many years of his reign of terror, extreme fear, terror. Ah, but it's not only the state which has mastered this strategy of controlling people through fear. The church also has applied it with awful effectiveness. I speak of the church in general, of course, but for many, many centuries, even up to the present time, the Saul church has used fear as a tool for controlling the sheep, or shall we say, controlling the cattle. Remember, Saul was a cattleman, not a shepherd, right? This will be review for many of you, but there is one doctrine above all others which utilizes fear and has allowed the Saul church hierarchy to control the minds and thus control the lives of people. Does anyone want to guess what that doctrine is? Say hell no. Yes, it's the doctrine of the eternal hellfire. In a nutshell, here's how it works. Somewhere in the early stages of the Christian church, some leaders realized that most people fear death, but far more people fear great pain associated with dying, much worse than they fear the fact of being dead. And so the leaders thought to themselves, gosh, if people fear pain more than they do their actual dying, then if we could just get them to believe that we have the power over their soul's eternal destiny, and if they don't do what we say, then when they die, that God will torture them for all eternity in a burning hell, well, bless my soul, I think we've just come up with the ultimate form of people control. Think of that. For centuries, the Christian people themselves actually gave away power over themselves to the Saul church by believing that God would actually do such a thing. I was taught that doctrine as a child. I believed it, and I can tell you it struck fear in me. And I was a good little Roman Catholic, as were lots of you. For all my childhood, my teenage years, I was a good Catholic until the time I left the seminary, and that's when I left Catholicism too. Well, we've covered the doctrine of eternal hellfire extensively in the follow-up album to our series on the sovereignty of God. You can look for it in our catalog or on the order form. So if some of you new listeners want an in-depth study of it, the album is called It's Hell or Nothing. That refers to the other alternative of some Christian denominations, nothingness or final annihilationism. 2 Samuel 17:17 now. Now Jonathan and Ahimaaz stayed by Enrogel, for they might not be seen to come into the city, and a wench, what an old English word, right? Means a maidservant, went and told them, and they went and told King David. Now in the standard manner of Hebrew historians, the writer of 2 Samuel here gives a one-sentence summary, and then proceeds in the succeeding verses to fill in the details. Now, back when I was a student at the Ohio State University School of Journalism, I was taught this method as the standard procedure for writing news stories. It's called the pyramid method, because the most important facts are put into the lead sentence at the top of the pyramid, and then the story spreads out from there, filling in the facts of lesser importance. I mentioned at the outset of today's message that while the two high priests actually went into Jerusalem, that the two sons did not. Here it tells us that they lodged at Enrogel. Back in the book of Joshua, we find Enrogel was an important landmark designating part of the border between the territories of Judah and Benjamin. And I had another map, and I can't locate it right now, which had all the tribe borders. But basically, Benjamin's territory was right in here. So it was, or right in here, top of the Dead Sea area. There's debate about the actual meaning of that word in Rogel, but many think that it means fuller's fountain. How many of you know what a fuller is? You know, it never dawned. Who's heard of the Fuller Brush Company?
Yeah.
Okay. What's a fuller?
It was a soap.
Yeah, it was soap. And that's because a fuller is what we call a laundryman today, or, you know, the laundromat is the place of the fuller today.
Actually, it was before that. It was to shrink the cloth. After it was woven, they put it through these vats and then pound it, and that was to take all the shrink out.
Okay. I didn't know about that, but the Bible dictionary say it was just the ones who stomped on the clothes and did the laundry, basically. But I'm sure that's correct, Lynn. If you remember about the fuller in the book of Malachi, that would lead us on about a two-hour side trip, but let me just quote the verses for you as food for thought. Malachi 3, 2 and 3, talking about the second coming. But who may abide the day of his coming? Who shall stand when he appeareth? For he is like a refiner's fire and like fuller's soap. And he shall sit as a refiner and purifier of silver, and he shall purify the sons of Levi and purge them as gold and silver, that they may offer unto Yahweh an offering in righteousness. It's prophesying about the New Testament priesthood, isn't it? Says the sons of Levi, but in the New Testament becomes the order of Melchizedek. Here, apparently, the sons of the high priests were known as partisans of David, and therefore they would not risk being in Jerusalem with Absalom, lest they be unable to get out of town to report to David. It seems, therefore, that the high priests entrusted one of their maidservants to relay the intelligence to the boys at En-Rogel, and unfortunately, they were spotted. And we'll stop there and take a break.